Every year, November 11th marks Remembrance Day in Canada and Veterans Day in the United States. Normally regarded as a time to reflect on war and the sacrifice, but also seen by some as an almost religious worship of militarism and nationalism that feeds into ongoing wars fought with lies, as well as bombs for financial and global objectives. On today's program, we hear reflections on the national holidays from former military men turned activist Stan Goff. We also hear from Iraq war deserter Joshua Key about what led to his decision to abandon his post and flee to Canada. Bringing you the analysis from beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for November 11th, 2016. I'm series contributor John Wilson, filling in for Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is brought to you by a special collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and Campus and Community Radio Station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe, the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available on the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We begin the show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research website. Trump said that he no longer sees the point of NATO 25 years after the Soviet collapse. If he sticks to his view, it means a big political change in Washington's EU vassals. The hostility toward Russia of the current EU and NATO officials would have to cease. German Chancellor Merkel would have to change her spots or be replaced. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg would have to be dismissed. We do not know who Trump will select to serve in his government. It is likely that Trump is unfamiliar with the various possibilities and their positions on issues. It really depends on who is advising Trump and what advice they give him. Once we see his government, we will know whether we can be hopeful for the changes that have now a chance. If the oligarchy is unable to control Trump and he is actually successful in curbing the power and budget of the military security complex and in holding the financial sector politically accountable, Trump could be assassinated. That is from The Working Class Won the Election, What Kind of Trump Administration? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted November 10th. Israel's restrictions on access to the holy sites in Jerusalem and Hebron have recently been complemented with bans on the daily call to prayer. In Hebron, the practice has been ongoing for a number of years and included the call being silenced 49 times in January 2014, 52 times in December 2015, and 83 times last month. The practice seems to be spreading to Jerusalem. Israel recently banned three mosques in Abu Dis from broadcasting the morning call. Lawyer Bassam Bar, head of the local committee in Abu Dis, condemned the unjustified ban, saying, quote, "Israel attacks Palestinians in all aspects of their lives." It seems that the ban was a response to complaints from illegal settlers in nearby Pisgat Ziv, who complained to Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat about the noise pollution coming from local mosques. Both Barkat and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are clearly set on applying the unbearable noise law to the call to prayer. The mayor and prime minister know the importance of the call to prayer to the Muslim community. Their plan to eradicate it from the air of Jerusalem to appease illegal settlers shows that neither has the wisdom of Khalaf Umar. Their plan has not only enraged Palestinians, but also damaged yet further attempts to create a climate that will lead to peace. It is most definitely part of Israel's attempt to Judaize Jerusalem and empty the holy city of its Islamic and Christian heritage. This is from Israel's ban on Muslim prayer, just the tip of the iceberg, written by Professor Kamal Hawash, posted November 10th. The voters' message was, you, the political elite, have hurt and harmed us these past 8 years. You have ignored us and left us behind while ensuring your wealthy friends recovered quickly and well from the 2009 crash. We have experienced great anxiety and insecurity. Now have a taste of that yourself. Trump's campaign gaffes, his personal character, his missteps, and outrageous off-the-cuff statements, his lack of any government experience, only enhanced the view that he was not just another elite politician. His lack of TV ad spending, absence of so-called ground game organization to turn out the vote, his having lost all three TV debates, according to pundits in the press, his lack of field organization and poorly run Republican Party convention, all that was irrelevant. What his win, in spite of all the conventional political wisdom of what it takes to win an election, reflects is that the equation of politics is changing in the U.S. as the people, the masses, to use jargon of prior times, are entering the political arena as a political force. And that fact is not just revealed in Trump's election. It was evident in Britain's recent Brexit referendum to leave the European Union. It will next be reflected in Italy's vote this coming December, in which political elite proposals for political reform to give them more power will also be rejected. It will reflect thereafter in the increasingly likely election of the far-right National Front in French elections next year, and could further reflect in German elections thereafter, in which that country's long-standing and presumably untouchable political leader Angela Merkel may also be overturned. This from the article "Why Trump Won and What's Next" by Jack Rasmus, posted November 10th. While the U.S. poses as morally bound to block its weapons deal with the Philippines, it continues to supply the nation of Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of advanced weaponry, including air-delivered munitions, warplanes, and main battle tanks. In fact, according to The Guardian, in 2010, the U.S. approved of a recent weapons deal amounting to $60 billion, the largest such deal in U.S. history. It included the delivery of additional F-15 fighters, Apache gunships, and Black Hawk transport helicopters, many of the weapons now being used in armed aggression against neighboring Yemen. The war in Yemen, prosecuted by Riyadh with U.S. and European weaponry, has become a growing humanitarian disaster, with even the U.S. and Europe's own human rights advocacy groups forced to acknowledge the growing abuses being carried out by America and Europe's close Arab ally. And just this year, Reuters would report that the U.S. Senate approved of an additional $1.15 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia for the delivery of over 130 M1 Abrams main battle tanks, as well as 20 armored recovery vehicles and additional equipment to support the newly acquired systems. Indeed, the torrent of weapons the United States supplies the Saudis in the face of a recent block on rifle sales to the Philippines proves the United States places politics over principles. Special interests in Washington use such principles merely as a politically convenient prop when the opportunity presents itself, and otherwise views such principles as a surmountable obstacle to be effortlessly skipped over. This is from Politics Over Principles, U.S. Denies Philippines Weapons, Continues Arming Saudis, written by Olson Gunnar, posted November 10th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Stan Goff has had a long military career prior to becoming a writer and activist. He served during the Vietnam War and served several other terms, eventually becoming Special Forces in the late 80s. Goff became politically active after ending his military career, adopting anti-imperialist and feminist views, and has written several books, including his most recent titled Borderline: Reflections on War, Sex, and Church. Here we get his reflections on Veterans Day.
Career military man. I actually retired from the military about 20 years ago, which gives you an indication how old I am. I'm actually 65. And something I was telling a group recently elections were 2 days after a pretty shocking election in the United States, but elections and Veterans Day are both actually national rituals. As part of a kind of American liturgy. I mean, by liturgy, I mean, you know, from the Greek word, it means work of the people, and it's usually associated with worship. And I'm a practicing Christian. A couple theologians, William Kavanaugh and Stanley Hauerwas, would say is that in the United States, you know, you don't have You don't have Christians who happen to be American. You have people who are Americans first and only Christians afterwards. And that's why you see that nationalism is actually our civil religion. And Hauerwas is sort of irascible, and he says, you know, you know what people truly believe in when you find out what they're willing to die or to kill for. And the overwhelming majority of Americans, they believe that that this nation is worthy of a blood sacrifice. But if I turn around and if someone told you, you know, that they would die or kill for a religious community, you call them a crackpot. But it's considered perfectly okay. Say they're going to die for the nation. So the nation is really our God. And these holidays and self-congratulatory elections and so forth are part of this liturgy, part of this. When you talk about a liturgy as a work of the people, you're saying it's what amalgamates individual persons into a collective. You know, it's rituals. The rituals within liturgies have a language, and they have gestures that sort of induce this repetitious rememorization of the things that are considered indispensable to your group identity. Yeah. It's kind of a ritual remembering, and it constructs the way that communities actually perceive reality. That's why you end up with things like American exceptionalism, because we just have this American point of view that's been constructed through these kinds of ritual remembrances. You do the comparison of that. Now, I'm a Catholic, and I attend Mass, you know, and the central ritual for us is communion, and it's sacred. It's a sacrament. It involves veneration and reverence and this sense of transcendence. You know, it's our corporal connection with God. But the thing is that, you know, you could talk to someone who's a heroin addict, and they'll tell you their first dose of heroin was like seeing God. So this sense of kind of transcendent awe can be sort of ginned up in response to a whole lot of things. And emotional attachment to those things begins even before you have the chance to think about them. You start thinking about things like, family as it's sentimentally constructed, free market, nation, global missions, and all those kinds of things. You don't have any critical capacity when you start to learn those. You learn them at your mother's breast. You learn them under your father's gaze. I mean, and that makes the associations of these things, kind of the emotional resonance that we feel when we talk about things like nationalism and patriotism, and when we go through this Veterans Day ritual, it makes that resonance a lot more powerful. And it makes it more difficult to sort of penetrate with any kind of criticism. And I was like that. I mean, I was like that. I thought that the Constitution was a sacred document. And, you know, when I joined the military, and every time I reenlisted in the military, I raised my right hand. And what we said, I can remember it by rote. It's I do solemnly swear to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. You know, and then I went off to training and all that stuff. And then it popped me out to Vietnam. And in Vietnam and seven other conflict areas, you know, I never encountered a single enemy of the Constitution. It's just a lot of poor people we're making war on. But everybody doesn't include that from their service because they're so committed to their group identity. You know. So I think that's what we're going to see. I know that Veterans Day initially was in remembrance as initially. Almost a celebration of peace, you know. But what it's become now is really a celebration of militarism.
I remember when I was younger, like kind of it was remembering the sacrifice, you know, past that now people don't have to do this kind of sacrificing anymore. But now it's more towards it's in the present and the future. Sacrifices.
Yeah. Yeah, blood sacrifice. I mean, and that really is that whole idea is an outgrowth of Christendom. Really, in the United States, we didn't celebrate that kind of thing here historically. until the Civil War, because the American Civil War was such a sanguinary affair that they had to find some way to justify the loss of life and limb that went on there. And it was really, I mean, Abraham Lincoln can be held responsible for the kind of flag-waving patriotism. The first time that patriotism was understood as kind of a civil religion was during the American Civil War and thereafter. And that actually kind of died down some years after that, and because there was still a lot of animosity between the North and South. And then with World War One, once again, another bloody mess of an affair. Soldiers from the North and South fought together, and it was sort of what that was actually when the Civil War was overcome. But in the meantime, there was this notion. There was a guy named Harry Stout who wrote a wonderful book on the Civil War called Upon the Altar of the Nation, and that's what his whole thesis was about, that war and how it consolidated American patriotism as a civil religion. It happened all the sort of characteristics we would ascribe to religion, with the nation itself being the godhead or the deity, you know.
Do you see?
Go ahead.
Do you see the way, you know, Veterans Day and Remembrance Day are, you know, worshiping nationalism? Do you think it's changed, you know, since you began, you know, your military service in the '70s? How has it changed in that time?
It's become much, much worse. excuse me. When I went in the Army in January 1970, the country was really divided over the whole question of Vietnam, and militarism was being brought into question. A lot of other things were being brought into question. That was a period of intense social turmoil in the United States. And then, you know, there were several shifts in public attitudes over the years. And by, you know, when George H.W. Bush invaded Iraq and had his little minor victory there, he said, you know, we've broken the Vietnam syndrome, you know. What was interesting about it, but then, of course, there was the, you know, after 9/11, it's become far more militaristic, because we're taught, you know, everyone that puts on a uniform is a hero and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, the veneration of veterans is just mortars on idolatry. But what was interesting about the period after Vietnam, especially after we were defeated in Vietnam, you know, the occupation was expelled, was how it was seen, and I talk a lot about gender as an aspect of militarism. It's not often discussed, but was you started seeing a spate of these splatter flicks coming out in sort of the popular culture, Death Wish and Dirty Harry and all these things, were almost an attempt to reclaim that violent masculinity. Before that, the stories that I grew up with were westerns. That's when the Cold War western was really popular, and it really was something that sort of mapped onto the Cold War narrative in the United States. But it was always, you know, it was about men who represented civilization, and they were fighting savages, and they were redeeming the world at the end of every story. They redeemed the world with violence. So, you know, we talk about that a lot of times, but we don't often talk about how important that notion of masculinity is in that whole narrative. Because militarism, it constructs masculinity in a particular way. Militaristic societies construct masculinity a certain way. And if you have a community shaped by war, and they've generalized this construction of masculinity as domination and conquest and willingness to engage in, even celebrate violence, and then this conquest masculinity, this idea of redemption through violence, becomes a norm. It becomes a norm. It becomes a masculine archetype that men come to live into. And if they can't live into it directly, they live into it vicariously. Everybody can't play in the NFL, but everybody can sort of celebrate the football culture. You see what I'm saying? And the same thing, you know, everybody can't be a warrior, but we can all celebrate the warrior as our icon. We can support the troops. It's kind of our national loyalty oath. I'm not sure. I think the reason it's important is because, you know, there's always been sort of a controversy on the left ever since Hegel and Marx, I guess, you know, about does the idea give birth to the material reality? Does the material reality, is it expressed in the idea? You know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And there's kind of this really a recursive feedback loop. But it's very important because what you find is in people's support for militarism, there's an idea of the masculine, of the national masculinity that reproduces war, and then the war turns around and reproduces this conquest masculinity. You see what I'm saying? it's one of those things, like I say, that's not often emphasized in the anti-war movements or in politics of resistance or in critiques of imperialism and all that, but I've come to believe that it's really important because it's the psychological foundation of the continued support for militarism in the society. It becomes very personal. It becomes a way that I defend my own sexual identity, is by supporting violence, supporting the idea of redemptive violence, supporting this sort of masculinized military nationalism. it's a calamity. You can see what it's done to our society. It's a calamity for an individual. It's a calamity for societies to sort of see life and social policy and everything else sort of developed in the context of a massive risk management project with violence at its core.
Right.
You know, and men pay a heavy price for that. In terms psychologically, we pay a heavy price for it because it cuts us off from our flight from what we could perceive to be femininity and weakness and so forth ends up being a flight from vulnerability. If you don't have vulnerability, you can't have intimacy. If you can't have intimacy, you can't have love. I mean, so you end up having crappy relationships in your personal life, and it's actually a reflection of some of these more generalized cultural attitudes. I can kind of go off on a tangent. I just wrote a whole book about that called Borderline. It was published last year. You can't just dispense with your entire episteme, you know what I mean? Are you lost out there, and everybody's sort of imbricated into their own families and communities and cultures, and it takes a while to understand something that later on might seem perfectly clear, you know what I mean? Vietnam certainly exposed me to my own capacity for racism, because before I went there, I thought, you know, I'm not a racist. And by the time I left there, I hated Vietnamese. But now that I've had a chance to reflect back on it, it's because when you're in a war of occupation and you're obliged to control a population, you can't grant that population their full humanity. You have to dehumanize them to an extent to make it possible to do your job, which means controlling them or pushing them around or beating them or killing them or burning their houses or killing their livestock or whatever it is that you're required to do in the course of doing your quote job. So you end up, and that's why, you know, you get a special name. You become a gook or a haji. You've got to give somebody a name that strips them of their essential humanity to make it possible to do what it is that you're going to do, which is control these people. You're going to treat them like cattle or like potential enemies. That was clear after I left Vietnam, but the rest of it wasn't. I think probably a big turning point for me was in the 80s when I was working in Latin America, because there was such a disconnect between what was being told to the public and what I was actually involved in, particularly when I was working directly out of embassies. And I watched as people sort of developed these public pronouncements, and that, you know, it became pretty clear that anything that a public official says, if it reflects the truth, that's only incidental. The purpose of it is not to express facts or to give people the facts or to give people the truth. It's to gain support for acquiescence to a particular agenda. When I worked in several countries in Latin America, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, Colombia, Peru, Venezuela, I was all over the place down there. The army is divided up into, well, the military is divided up into theater commands. And everything south of the border in this continent is called Southcom, you know, like we own the place, right? Well, back then, Fort Clayton, Panama was where the Southcom headquarters was. Before we deployed to any one of these countries, we'd have to go through Southcom, and you'd receive your INSUM, it's called. It's an intelligence summary from an intelligence officer. And, you know, we'd be briefed on, while we were down there, what we were supposed to tell people, family, friends, public, you know, the press, everybody. We had a story that went in. The cover stories were all lies. They were just bald-faced lies. It was like, oh, we're down here doing drug interdiction, blah, blah, blah. And we were doing all counterinsurgency down there. We were just assisting them in increasing their capacity to make war on their own people. and oftentimes, and like I say, I worked right out of the embassies. And when you find out, you know, the ambassador doesn't spend most of his time with the heads of state, he doesn't spend most of his time. My ambassadors were all men. Doesn't spend most of his time with their military people. He spends it with the Chamber of Commerce, the host nation Chamber of Commerce, and that's kind of where I started to get a clue. Well, you know, later on, I'd read about Smedley Butler, the Marine dissident. He was awarded the Medal of Honor like 3 times. This guy was like a legend, and he turned against the whole thing, and he kind of expressed it very pithily. He said the troops follow the flag, the flag follows the dollar, and the troops follow the flag. Yep. And that pretty well summed it up. But I got a firsthand look at that when I was in Latin America, and I think that was kind of a turning point for me. I was never comfortable with what I was doing in the military after that. And my final deployment to that region was in 1994 to Haiti, when we did the invasion of Haiti down there. You know, once again, we told the public one thing and did something completely contrary to that on the ground. And, you know, that was a point where I was almost put in jail. it was a tough deployment. And unfortunately, I got out not too much longer after that. But by the time I'd gotten out, I completely rejected the foreign policy. I can't say that I came to oppose militarism at that point, but I certainly opposed U.S. foreign policy, became very critical of that, became very active in politics. So when I started to get involved in the militarism aspect of it was after 9/11. Because, I guess, you know, you remember for a few days there, it was like people were frightened to say anything if they didn't agree with the idea of going out and dropping bombs on Afghanistan. And, you know what I mean? So the people who wanted to resist what was about to take place in the government sought out anti-war veterans as part of their movement, because we inoculated them against charges that they were anti-patriotic, you know?
Right.
And that was the point where I had to start speaking about militarism. But when I started speaking about militarism, I realized that I wasn't comfortable with the depth of my understanding of militarism. And that's when I actually started to sort of study it in earnest. And it was at that point, I think, within a couple of years that I recognized that one of the elephants in the room and talking about militarism was this whole thing about gender, this whole thing about how this violent masculinity reproduces war, and in war itself turns around and reproduces this violent masculinity. And that if we were going to disrupt that as a social force, we had to disrupt that cycle some way. We had to talk about gender as an essential aspect of militarism. So yeah.
So what effect do you say that has on all the women serving in the military as like kind of a male dominance aspect of militarism?
Yeah, it's Zilla Eisenstein calls them female decoys. There's actually not that many women in the military. In some of the non-frontline services, it's about 15%, and then it's much, much lower as you start getting closer and closer to the combat arms. And women in the military are in much more danger, even in combat zones, from their fellow soldiers. They're more danger of being raped than they are of being shot by the enemy or whatever. So this idea of a gender decoy, I call it the G.I. Jane formula, you know. And it was really there in underwrote this idea that if you elect a woman as the president of the United States, that's kind of a moot point now, but it's more important what that woman actually believes and does, the chief executive and blah, blah. You know, the G.I. Jane thing is you get a few women who are accepted into traditionally male positions as long as they uphold the standards and the objectives and the values of the males that went before them, see, because what we've done is ideologically disappeared what was gendered about these positions or professions or actions before women had access. So either in the film G.I. Jane, if you remember that one, with Demi Moore's awful film, it was terrible.
Right. Yeah.
But the protagonist, she fights this male exclusion to become a Navy SEAL, you know, and then there's this climax scene where she beats up her instructor who's been picking on her the whole time. And then when she stands over him after she beats him up, she hollers out at the guy. I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but she says, "Suck my dick." It's like, whoa, where did that come from? Is it, well, this demand for sexual tribute as a sign of submission was male. It was even anatomically male. And so now we know that Demi Moore's character is an honorary male, and that's what we have. We have more and more women serving as decoys because they're actually serving as honorary males, but they're not subverting patriarchy in any essential way. They're just displaying conquest masculinity. And so Demi Moore's character, G.I. Jane, fits herself into the male model, right? And she's even got the imaginary penis, right? And she finally proves herself in battle in the last part of the film. She's a fully fledged SEAL now by killing Arabs. Huh. So you see what I'm saying? So what Eisenstein says that in a society as pluralistic as the United States, as cosmopolitan as the United States, that male social power no longer, as it does in, you know, earlier societies, have like this one monolithic script for women. So what Eisenstein said is that modern society is constantly renegotiating masculinity and femininity, and they use these gender decoys, these individual women in power and individual women who are spokespersons for male-dominated enterprises, but they're still dominated by males and for males. They just have these decoys to make it look as if they're not. And it makes it tough for people to understand, because you look at these gender decoys, it diverts us. You know what I mean? People say, well, you know, if war, like you said, if war is a male enterprise, well, what about these women? Or, mm-hmm. you know, when wars are still run predominantly by men, when the power is still vested in men, the overwhelming majority of women are still subject to the same crap from men that they were before you had a few of these women who became honorary males. You know, there's nothing about like the hawkishness of a Hillary Clinton or a Golda Meir or Indira Gandhi or Margaret Thatcher, right? None of that subverted male hegemony. None of it changed the conquest masculinity that you see in popular media and films and so forth that again supports militarism. And none of it changed the misogynistic character of the military. A woman is in far more danger from her fellow soldiers in the military than she is from the enemy, even in combat zones. So these boundaries, they stayed there. These boundaries, they between men and women, they stated, not just boundaries between men and women. The conquest masculinity is a boundary between men and women, between men and nature. Men conquer nature, between imperial men and their colonies. You know what I mean? Again, the civilization and the Theodore Roosevelt figure that goes out and tames the savages. We just changed the window dressing. So this honorary male, who's a visible female, just like an honorary white person who's not white, another decoy. If you get Clarence Thomas, for example, right. They don't subvert power. They don't change anything structurally. They accommodate it. Mm. But even more important than their accommodation, this decoy phenomenon conceals the real intersections of power. You got, if Hillary Clinton had won, or even in her role as Secretary of State, right. she can bomb poor brown women in Libya or Sudan or Afghanistan. She can still support Saudi Arabia, for God's sake, as long as she stands up for enough American women in some way, as long as she participates in American exceptionalism, she can conceal this other stuff that's mystified because it's so far out of sight, out of mind, you know what I mean? And so she can still be an honorary male, but she has to continue to support the war. And had she been elected, I suspect that she may have overcompensated and become even more hawkish to prove that she was up to it. And our veneration of veterans is not just a celebration of war. It is a celebration of our national masculinity. When masculinity is being not like woman, not vulnerable, our masculinity becomes our flight from vulnerability. We're talking about people going out there and man up on the national defensive perimeter, it's all about reducing our vulnerability. Well, you know, this idea of vulnerability as a minus, you can look at that as an individual male psychologically in constructing a sexual identity, all the way up to the way that we perceive things like national security.
How do people react to you as a critic and a veteran?
Well, that's interesting because there's kind of two different aspects to that in a way. One is that I'm allowed to say a lot of things that other people wouldn't get away with, right?
Right.
because I'm a veteran, and people where they would get belligerent with another person for saying the same thing, they don't say the same thing to me, because it's almost like, well, you know, he's earned the right to do that because he went to war, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem with it sometimes, and it allows, see, veterans are going to have, we've got the floor whether we like it or not, you know, whether the veneration of veterans is justified or not. That's kind of a contradictory place for me, because I don't want to promote the veneration of veterans, but then again, the reason that people are listening to me is because I'm a veteran, you see what I'm saying? But the other problem with it is, and it becomes kind of tough, like I was given an address to a university here a few days ago about sort of the same thing. My CV in the military is it's in special operations, and that's been, there's this, the entertainment media has given special operations this crazy mystique, right? We're supposed to like bite the heads off of snakes and speak five languages and all that stuff, you know? So this mystique, it's part of the national mythology, but in the irony of me criticizing, you know, nationalism and militarism is the only reason I have any street cred. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that I'm always heard directly because of what people's impressions are of this before I come up there. I tend to be this screen on that people kind of project their own vague conceptions onto. So So I'm not sure that I'm always heard. So it's a very contradictory position to find oneself in. But at the same time, I don't think I'm not big on you know. So I want everybody to celebrate me because I changed my mind. I don't want everybody to worry about do I have PTSD, and because that ends up being sort of valorizing something as a sacrifice. Yeah, this stuff's not about me. My function should not be to go up there as a veteran, since I've got the floor whether I want it or not, and you know, try to construct myself as some sort of a counter narrative individually. The job of veterans, if they genuinely oppose war and militarism, is to be witnesses. You know, guess what we saw? Guess what we saw? Guess what we learned that you don't know? Guess what your country's pumping sunshine up your ass? That's the role that we can play, and we're effective at that sometimes.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Joshua Key is an Iraq war resistor who has been living in Canada for 10 years now, since deserting the U.S. Army after witnessing war crimes during his deployment in Iraq. For this Veterans Day / Remembrance Day episode, we play a speech Josh gave at the University of Winnipeg explaining what he went through in making this decision.
I'll just start off at the beginning. It was May of 2002. It was I was born and raised in Oklahoma, a little town called Guthrie. It was quite economically depressed, no work. I was a welder by trade, and I couldn't find welding jobs. Through high school and through my childhood, you see the military, you look at it, you have recruiters coming to our house. And in high school, I took what's called ROTC, which is like a program that sort of, it doesn't get you ready for the military, but it sort of, how would you put it, shows you what it's like in a sense. You know, you wear a uniform to school every week, you get graded, and sort of like a class. I got married young. I got married at 20 years old, and I had two children. My third was on the way, so it was quite, we needed something to pay the bills. I needed work. So I thought, well, I'm going to go talk to the military recruiter, see what they have to say. You know, I went to see one, and he said, well, you know, we'll give you this test, and after this test, it'll tell us where you could fit at in the military, and then we'll go from there. So I took their test, and they said, you have three choices of jobs. You can be a combat engineer, you can be a MLRS driver, which is a multiple launch rocket systems driver, or you can be an infantryman. At the time, it made more sense to me. Well, I want to build bridges. You know, that just made the complete sense, because that's what was explained to me, what combat engineer was. So it went, I had a contract. I signed a 3-year contract for the United States military. In that contract, it stated I wouldn't be sent outside the United States, that I'd be in the continental. That excludes Hawaii and Alaska. They said I wouldn't even go there. They said I would build bridges. They said I didn't get a money incentive. I didn't get college money. There was nothing of that nature. It was just, what duty station do you want to go to? And I said, well, I want to go to a non-deployable duty station, because in some sense that lessens my chance of ever having to go anywhere. And they said, well, Fort Carson, Colorado, that's a non-deployable duty station. No one ever leaves from there. You'll be there. So I picked that duty station. When I got to basic training, it was I had expected, you know, it's going to be rough. It's not going to be a walk in the park. We all knew that. I get there, and they said, within the first 2 days, they said, okay, you're going to learn to be the most devious killer on the battlefield. And I was thinking, okay, well, that doesn't make no sense to building bridges to that. And you learn very, very fast that your opinion doesn't matter. You drink water and drive on. You have no opinion. And the only thing your opinion is going to do is get you in a lot of trouble. Even at that point, though, my contract was void. It was null. There was nothing in there. They had already lied about my job. They had already said, well, you'll be, you know, CONUS. So I had thought, doesn't matter. You just go about your mission. You learn real fast. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be trained in explosives and landmines, I'll do my best at it. So I went to school. I learned how to do all the necessary things for blowing things up, learning all about landmines, and it became exciting. I seen it as, well, this ain't too bad. But then you know in the back of your head, well, you're not going to be doing this in the continental United States of America, because where are they going to need anyone to do landmines or blow buildings up? It was still, though, I mean, very, our basic training was learned. We looked at, if you're not American, you're nothing. You know, we have derogatory terms for every race. It was, if you're not American, then you're a Haji, you're many other names I won't repeat right now. But it was always derogatory, and they did that for a reason, to desensitize us. If we look at everything else in the world like it's nothing, and we're the superior, well, then there's not a problem killing them, people, because they're nothing to us. They mean nothing. It was through basic training that you sort of, I always said when I went, oh, they won't break me down. They won't break me down. They're not going to do that. I'm already 23 years old. I'm, you know, in my basic training, they considered me the grandpa compared to all the other kids, because they were 17 and 18-year-old kids. When I graduated basic training. I graduated my AIT, which is Advanced Individual Training, and I was sent to Fort Carson, Colorado. When I got to Fort Carson, Colorado, I was there with three other guys that I did basic training with. When they handed us our patches to what unit we was going to go with, I knew that their patch is non-deployable. It was the 4th Engineers. That means they're not going to go anywhere. And they handed me this weird-looking patch, and I'm like, well, what is this? They're like, oh, you'll find out soon enough. And then here come you know, my squad leader to come pick me up, and he's like, oh, get ready, because we've been in every battle since war began. And I was thinking, okay, this is, it was all lies then. So I said, I'm going to go to my superior officer and ask him, why is everything in that contract voided? I know that I didn't have an opinion, but I was wanting to ask, why has everything been, there was nothing right. I walked into my superior's office, I got at attention, I did all proper respects, and I said, sir, why is it everything is wrong here? He said, soldier, you don't know the military way of life yet, and get the hell out of my office. And then for about the next few weeks, I was hazed, just you're doing push-ups all the time, stuff you really just, it was really nothing, you just do it and go on. But I learned, you don't ask a question, and you sure don't go right to your superior. There's a chain of command, so you have to ask this person, and this person all the way up the line before you have the right to do that. And then we played war games. We were playing war games. They kept telling us that when we go to Iraq, because it was already being talked about in October of 2002, we were playing war games in the fashion of, it's going to be tank battles. We'll be in the desert, there's going to be major tank battles, and we will not go into the cities, and this is how it's going to be. So we trained in getting rid of landmine fields, blowing them up in place just to go on. It was April 1st of 2003. The war had been going on for a matter of about 2 to 3 weeks, and I got my orders to go to Iraq. I thought at the time, even at that time, it was weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is an evil tyrant that has to be dealt with. So I believed in the mission very much. I had three young boys. I knew that I wanted to take care of this before they got older and had to take care of it themselves. So I believed in it. On April 10th, I flew to Kuwait. We got to Kuwait. We landed. They didn't have enough water or food. The water supply, we were rationed to 1 liter of water a day and to one MRE, which is meal ready to eat, sort of in a bag, lasts forever, tastes like dog food for the most part. And it was, but we were getting ready. You know, this, and then they said, okay, well, we're going to go into Iraq tomorrow, so you guys need to go through this compound, steal all the water you can from all your fellow soldiers, and so we can get ready to go. So the night before, we all went to different tents. We took all the water from our fellow soldiers that were in the same camp, because we needed it when we went across the border. When I got to Iraq, I went to Ramadi. When we went to Ramadi, it was a city of 300,000 Iraqis, and there was 120 of us. No American soldiers in that city yet, and they said the bridge can't stand a tank, so you guys are going to have to go in on foot and keep this city under control. And we're already thinking to ourselves, this is crazy. How can we do anything to 300,000 Iraqis when there's 120 of us? But that was at first. There wasn't no violence at first. You know, we walked in. And actually, their bridge that wouldn't handle a tank was made by the British, and you could go about 20 tanks right over the top of the bridge. When we got into the city, it was very nonviolent for the first month. We got taught how to raid homes, do traffic control points. Raiding homes began that night. I'll just go through a raid. We would go in with a 5 to 6 man team. We'd put a C4 charge on the front door, blow the front door in. We'd run in, take all male occupants over 5 foot tall to be sent outside and zip cuffed to be sent off for interrogations. We take women and children, hold them at gunpoint, go through the house, searching the house, and then we got to where we take whatever we wanted from the house. We would take their money, we would take their jewelry, we would take even the TV if we needed a TV. We learned real fast, there was no one watching us. We could do anything we wanted. There was no code that we were going by. We were doing whatever we wanted. As these raids continued, you know, it was, I did 200 when I was there, very massive scale. We would do whole neighborhoods at once, all the way down to individual homes. We didn't just pick them. We had satellite imagery of them houses. There were supposed to be potential terrorists in the house, caches of weapons in the house. There was something supposed to be present in that house. I never found nothing. We never found nothing to justify us doing that. But the males were still sent off for interrogation and whatever was done afterwards. Through my time there, I went to Ramadi, to Fallujah, to Al-Kahim on the Syrian border, to two villages in between Habani and Chaldea. All them locations, we did things the same. We raided homes, we did traffic control points. And then the violence had changed. From the first month compared to the second month, it went from peacekeeping to war, you know, at a very massive scale. We went from the first month, no firefights, you're not getting mortared through the night, there's nothing, to within a month, we're getting mortared all night long, so you have to change your locations, because when one mortar hits, that means they're just walking them in on you. So there's someone watching at far, so they're like, okay, well now this is where they're at, so the next one hit right where you were sleeping. So you'd have to keep moving locations all through the night so you didn't get hit. Firefights would happen on a daily basis every time we went out the gates. So, you know, it was very intense. It happens in like 2 seconds. You know, all of a sudden the ground starts shaking, RPGs start flying, tanks are firing, and then you're firing, and we're all in a daze because you never seen who you're firing at. You never seen the combatants. There was no combatants. Through my time there, the reason I'm in Canada is, to myself, there was no justification for what we were doing, especially on a moral standpoint. As my time in Iraq, like in Ramadi, I was on a QRF mission, which means a quick reaction force for the military. We got the call at 1-2 o'clock in the morning. We could hear the machine gun fire in afar, so we were already up getting our stuff on because we knew we were going to get called for it. Excuse me. We went out the gates of our compound, which was based in the city. We went to the banks of the Euphrates River, and we were going down. We took a sharp right turn. When we took that sharp right turn, on the left-hand side, there was two Iraqis with their heads decapitated, and we parked, pulling the 360 perimeter. I was told to get out to see if I can find evidence of a firefight, what had went on here. When I got out, there was already American soldiers on the ground. To the right of me, there was an American soldier, and there was a few around him, and he was hollering that they had lost it there. We had lost it. When I look over to the left, I see American soldiers kicking their heads around like a soccer ball. That's when I knew that that's not the call of a soldier. That's way beyond. We're losing our minds. I got back inside the tank. I told my squad leader, I'm not dealing with this. He looked at me crazy because I was defying an order. And the next morning, of course, I was approached, and I approached him. I said, through time and combat, where's the mission statement? I want to write exactly what I had seen last night so that there's a statement of that. I was told it was none of my concern and none of my business. Through time, that was a regular occurrence. Civilians are dying on a massive scale. They're dying all around just for no reason whatsoever, but they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Through that time, it was me and my fellow soldiers are talking to each other. We're trying to figure out what's going on because nothing's making sense. The only ones that are getting hurt are the innocent. The ones that are acting like the terrorists are us. It wasn't them. And then it was always the question, and the question I asked myself, if you flipped this scenario around and you came to my country and was doing this, there'd be 10 times the death. You know, it just, it was, that was the reality of it. It was November of 2003. They said, okay, Private Key, you get to go home for 2 weeks. We're going to let you go home for 2 weeks, and then you got to report back to Baghdad for an undisclosed, undetermined amount of months. That's when I told myself, okay, completely hush your mouth, because if you do anything to jeopardize this, well, of course, you're not getting to go. You're not going nowhere. And it was for a few weeks. I just sort of was waiting to go. I was waiting to go home. When I got on the plane and I went to Kuwait, and then I left Kuwait and I went to Ireland, and then when I got from Ireland to the United States, I didn't know what I was going to do. My mind wasn't made up. I didn't know I was going to leave. I didn't know I was going to be a deserter or any of that. I just knew that to myself, I couldn't morally go back there. So I called a military lawyer, and I asked the military lawyer, is there anything that I can do to stay in the military? I just do not want to go back to Iraq and participate. Anything. And he said, soldier, you have two choices. Either you get back on the plane and go to Iraq, or you're going to prison. At that time, I chose to run. I didn't see any other options to it. There was no other options to me. So I got my ex-wife, and I had three children. I got them inside of a 1978 Camaro, and I wanted to head east. My main reason for heading east, that's where the big cities are, Philadelphia, New York City, cities with a lot of violence. So why are they going to look for a deserter if there's people getting murdered every day? So we ended up in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, we lived underground for 14 months. Basically, you're jumping from hotel to hotel every 30 days because you're wanting to keep the radar off you. You're not wanting people to know anything. But within that time, the 14 months, I was starting to lose it. You know, paranoia, suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder. Every day you have to work. I had to work. So I drive to work and you're just scared to death because it ain't like that. The military was actively pursuing us. They didn't have the manpower for it. But if you get pulled over on a routine traffic stop or anything of that nature, they have you. And I'm going to go to prison or I'm going to go back to war. It was October of 2004. I started looking on the internet and I seen that there was American soldiers in Canada, in Toronto, applying for refugee status. The soldiers that were here were not Iraq veterans. But they were here, they were starting the process, and I started to contact their lawyer. Their lawyer said, well, if you come to Canada, we can't guarantee anything, but I will be your lawyer. Then there was a group called the War Resister Support Campaign, which was a group that is based in Toronto, but it's just of, now I've dealt with them for so many years, they're just great Canadian people that do it for nothing, and they help us stay here, they lobby, they do everything. I've never seen a group like them that do what they do. And I called Michelle, which is one of the organizers, and I said, okay, there's a lot of us, because I had another child when I was in Philadelphia on the run. I said, there's six of us in total. I need a place to come. And they said, well, no names. You make it across the border into Canada, give us a call, and we'll have everything set up for you. That was the hardest choice ever. People always say, well, you took the easy way out, you know, you just came to Canada, and it was the hardest thing ever to leave your country and leave everything you know. You know, you leave your family. I left my family, I left my mother, I left my brother, cousins, everyone, which a lot of them still won't talk to me now because I'm considered a coward and traitor. When we came across the border at Niagara Falls, it was March 8th of 2005. When we came across, you know, I was looking at the river flowing right there, and I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a cold jump if I got to jump because I ain't going back. So you're looking, and you're seeing ice floating in it, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not a good idea. We get to the border, and they say, okay, where are you going? We told them Toronto. I was advised by my lawyer not to claim for refugee status at the border. They said, why do you have all this luggage for?
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.